Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Andrea Cabral sitting in for Marjorie today. We're joined now on Zoom by food policy analyst, multiple James Beard winner, Corby Kummer. He's the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Hey, Corby.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Andrea.
Hey, hi. Corby. How are you? So, good Corby, you. Recently, I think there were a number of news reports that indicated that, you know, inflation is down from a high of, I think, 9% to now it's either at 3 or 2.9%. Yeah. Which is remarkable in just a few short years. But we're also seeing signs in different industries that there's still some struggle. And one of those is the restaurant industry. Talk a little bit about why restaurants seem to be feeling the pinch of a slowing economy versus so many other sectors which seem to be on the upswing.
First of all, restaurants are the bellwether of the economy. If business goes down in restaurants, it tends to forecast a general downturn in business in other industries, mostly because it's very discretionary spending. It's easy for people to pull back. It's considered a luxury. I am here in the mighty Aspen Institute, and one of my fellows here on my Food Leaders Fellowship is at McDonald's and was just talking about how affected they are by especially the pinch in lower income people. They feel the rising food prices and continuing inflation and continuing housing prices. Their business is going down. It's been widely reported. I'm revealing nothing that's a secret. And, you know, I saw this really well-reported Boston Globe piece with local restaurants saying it's down. And I thought this is so well-reported. Of course, Shirley Leung did it. But Andy Husbands from Smoke Shop was saying that he measures success or growth in the number of aluminum pans of barbecue beef and such that he measures every year. And in a good year recently, it was up 3%, and now it's down 1%. And Clayton Turnbull, a very successful entrepreneur who has over 24 Dunkin' Donuts. And Andrea, I see you nodding your head. He's a big community supporter. He's just a standby of the Boston community. And he was saying, we're okay for now, but we see business dropping at other fast food outlets. But it's mostly, it's a sign of inflation that hasn't gone down fast enough and food prices, which are really problematic.
You know, we discussed this with Shirley, who did write this yesterday. And I almost saw it as the opposite. As opposed to being a harbinger of things, bad things to come, this restaurant story that Shirley did, that it was rather a reflection of people going to restaurants. And the point she makes is instead of going out three nights a month, people going out two nights a month. When they get to the restaurant, they don't order an entree and a dessert. They order two appetizers, and, you know, whatever, spending less money. That people's perceptions of how the economy is going for them personally and in a bigger way is lagging behind the reality. Because as Andrea said, it's not just the lowest the inflation rate has been in, I think, 3 years at 2.9%, but the day before there was a consumer confidence kind of survey in which confidence is coming back in huge kinds of waves. So is it possible it's the reverse direction? Do you know am I articulating this well?
I do know
no?
what you mean, okay. Because it's been such a problem of the Biden administration that he's been blamed for bad inflation.
Right.
Bad economy when the numbers have actually been good. And why couldn't they move the ocean liner on public perception of the economy? I hope that's true, but it's being felt especially across the fast food industry. And the fast food industry is considered like the sensitive fingertip of the whole restaurant industry as to when spending starts to fall.
But the good thing in the fast food industry, I should say, is the McDonald's, the counter which you're talking about, is now doing those $5 specials,
yeah.
And a lot of the fast food places are mimicking them. And even though overall revenue may not be great, based upon what you said, Corby, the sale of these lower income, lower priced options, which is good news for low income people, even though the food isn't healthy, is booming. So it's price sensitive, obviously. Yes.
Yeah, but I overall business is down for McDonald's, and they're really concerned. So even if these loss leader things, which I think we discussed them on a previous show, McDonald's doesn't do these except under
I
duress.
understand
They
that.
don't like offering discounts. So yes, everybody should go out and take advantage of them, especially if they can find the most healthy thing they can eat
The
there. But
least
it's
unhealthy, I believe, is the correct expression.
Thank you,
You're
Jim.
welcome.
See, I think it's price gouging, and that's what I've thought this almost from the beginning, at least in terms of it being a major contributor to this. So,
By whom?
by everybody. I
You don't
happen
mean
to read.
independent restaurateurs. You
No,
mean that,
no.
oh.
I mean the people who are supplying the food, and in some cases, the retailers that are selling it. McDonald's prices seemed to go up almost exponentially and almost overnight, to the point where there were interviews with people on the street who were saying, "Wait a minute, I was just here, and this was like, a dollar 50 less." And if you read Robert Reich, and I do read Robert Le Reich, and I follow him, he's been talking about record profits being made by huge corporations like McDonald's, and a number of others. They're making billions and billions and billions of excessive revenue. Not, I'm talking beyond the revenue they should be making. And they're reporting these record profits every single year. So where does price gouging and vendors charging restaurateurs more for the food that they buy, where does that fall in this problem?
Obviously, it's part of the overall higher food prices they are getting. McDonald's may have had record profits, but their profits are going down and they're worried. Meat is a really good place to start attacking consolidation and industry. And there's a story today that Kamala Harris is going to on Friday come out with something the Biden administration was really loudly trumpeting and then gave up for a while, which was trying to break up this really bad meat processing monopoly, which has resulted in a lot of price gouging. So that the effects of smoke shop, which is mostly meat, just imagine meat prices, but the hands of like all of the country's meat are in the three meat companies control all of the processing plants. All of the meat that gets sold to large scale operators and vendors. There's a terrible choke point in slaughterhouses. The Biden administration was trying to fund through the USDA the funding of slaughterhouses and trying to improve the lot of animal raisers, large scale animal agriculture, but not as large scale and consolidated. Breaking up that monopoly would, I think, go a long way toward this inflation and higher food
By the
prices.
way, I think Harris is tomorrow in her economic speech, you're going to go even further than just the meat thing. They are suggesting, her people, that this will she'll propose the first ever federal ban on corporate price gouging in the food industry, specifically targeting these potential mergers between grocers and food producers, which does create these monopolies, which lead, I mean, why hasn't this been done before? You said Biden talked about it and didn't do it. Why didn't Obama do it? Why hasn't this been done?
They never wanted to take on the food industry, and it wasn't as egregious. Meat has been egregious for decades. And when I say egregious, what it means is everybody who grows feed for meat, they're forced to sell their product to only three companies. There's not competition for their product. Prices go up. They often go out of business because they can't be on a big enough scale to lower the prices that these very few customers insist on getting. So that's really bad. Supermarkets, I'm glad you brought that up and that they're going to attack it because in the Obama administration, there wasn't anything like the chokehold that there are on two big companies that control almost all the supermarkets in the country. That's really much worse under the Biden administration.
Did you two see the bull that ran away on that was being about to be taken to
Yeah.
the slaughterhouse and it just went crazy and ran away?
And
I
then they
don't
end up euthanizing
I
the
know.
poor thing, which is
Well,
absolutely
better
awful.
better than being
Right.
led to the
Right.
slaughterhouse,
No,
I
that's
would
true. I
say.
guess that's a weird kind of a true thing. So I eat a lot of salmon. I like salmon. I buy it. Usually I buy it at a place like Whole
I
Foods.
eat a lot of it too.
I do look to see whether or not it's fresh caught or farm raised. I pay attention to that kind of stuff. Only to now, read this story about salmon farms in Patagonia in Chile, and now I'm hugely worried about antibiotic levels in salmon and any one of a number of environmental impacts. I can't even enjoy salmon now. What is going on here?
Well, I see what's going on is you're taking the Marjorie role as it's my last pleasure denied me now.
Yes.
Because
yes.
of this new news story. This new news story is a very long piece in the New York Times about salmon farms in Chile extending down to Patagonia. Salmon are not native to these waters. They were never there. And so having thousands and millions of them in the waters with their feces, let's be really frank, and the runoff of the feed they're given, it's terrible for ocean systems. What I didn't read in this was stories of salmon being released in accidents, because that's definitely happened in Canada in the Northeast, where the tiny threatened stocks of wild salmon, which are carefully regulated, get diluted by genetically engineered salmon, which are approved but in small numbers, and basically by just another species of salmon that's been plunked into these farms, into these waters. In Patagonia and Chile, it's causing lots of runoff of feed, clouding of the waters, and even though there aren't that many traces of the antibiotics that are regularly given to all animals that are raised in incredibly unhealthy concentration so that they won't get ill from being so close to these millions of other animals, there haven't been that many residues in the salmon that have been coming into America, but there's some kind of byproduct bacteria that interacts with human bacteria and can create superbugs. So we have a lot to worry about, Andrea.
Well, I think it's called persiricatosis.
Exactly.
Is one of the bacteria.
One of my favorite
well
terms.
Done.
By the way, for those who think this is not relevant to your life, if you're a salmon eater like the two of us are, apparently half of the farm salmon that's eaten in the United States comes from these Chilean waters. This is a really big deal. So I have a question for, I don't understand anything about the chemistry of this thing. They say that while the salmon that is farm raised off in Patagonia or wherever it has all this crap in it, that whatever that crap is in Norway, where they also do salmon, there's zero amount of this.
Yeah,
whatever.
How is that possible?
How is that exactly? How is that possible? And why aren't they doing the same thing?
As I recall, and you know, Andrea, the Marjorie, Andrea, what am I going to do now?
Is Marjorie doesn't need salmon, but I know what you mean. Go ahead.
Buy Norway farmed salmon. And that's what I thought. It wasn't mentioned in the story, but you know, we're one expose away from not being able to buy Norway salmon. But they've traditionally been Norway's much better regulator of these farms. I think there's much less density in the water. There's much more regulation of what they're allowed to put into the water in terms of feed and antibiotics. So it's long had a very good reputation. So has Scottish Faroe Islands, F-A-R-O-E. I've never been there, but it's got a very high reputation in the food world for the quality of its farmed salmon. But overall picture, almost every piece of salmon we buy in the supermarket or order on a menu is raised on a farm. We have to think about these byproducts and problems of farmed salmon so we can start looking for Norway and Faroe Island. But most of all, we're about to get into wild salmon season from Alaska. It's very carefully regulated, but it's always the best choice environmentally.
Well, it may be the best choice environmentally. That's what I wanted to ask you. And also, is there an omega-3? That's why I started eating salmon, even though I now love it for the taste. Is there an omega-3 differential between wild and farmed? I think it used to be that wild was better, but I think it's mostly equal now.
And I think it's mostly equal. And I think for a while they were trying to pump the feed into farmed salmon that would up the omega-3 content. But just buy wild caught.
But the problem with wild, unless I'm missing something, is there absolutely no bones in these salmon fillets. The wild ones have these little tiny bones, don't they?
It has nothing to do with the salmon and everything to do with the processing plants that pack them. And it depends on, you know, how much slave labor you want to think about has gone into your nice piece of salmon on a plate. I'm kidding. It's not the same as like the tuna industry, which has a lot of child labor and slave labor. I have not read any scandal pieces about the labor conditions in these fish farms, but it's a question of how they run them through machines and which have enough human beings to go and pick the bones out. It's not particularly the salmon.
We're talking to Corby Kummer, our food guy.
So, Corby, usually when I hear about any species invading a place where humans live, I cheer for whatever the invading species is. It's just sort of a knee-jerk reaction I have,
I'm
because
really interested in that.
I consider humans to be the most parasitic of species. So anything that happens with another
Yikes.
species, you know, I give I if they get a leg up, good for them. But Italy is currently seeming to have a problem with a blue crab invasion. Blue crabs, I actually think, are kind of pretty. But part of what I love about this story is the fact that it's believed that the crabs got there across the Atlantic as stowaways. So I have this notion of these blue crabs kind of sneaking into ships and getting all the way to Italy just to invade it. But tell us, this really does have some, because, you know, crabs are predators. Really does have some downside for their marine ecosystem.
Yeah, like it is not charming if you are a clam fisherman or woman
Or a
off
clam.
the coast of Venice who has lost your ability to make a living because these blue crabs are giant, they're predators, and they're decimating the population of seafood in the Adriatic around Venice. I found it incredibly ironic because I've always found the crabs that are available in Italy to be a little wan, tasteless, chewy.
Excuse me.
And blue crabs are like an obsession in the Chesapeake Bay. There was a wonderful book by William Weaver called Beautiful Swimmers about the blue crab. And it's a romantic look at these gorgeous crabs. And then Weaver was worried about the population being threatened by climate change. The reason these stowaway blue crabs you find such romantic pirates, Andrea, have taken hold in the waters off Venice is because the waters are much warmer. They would not have housed or been hospitable to blue crabs in the past, but now, because of global warming, they are, and they're eating up all the local species. Invasive species are never a romantic story. Think about not Japanese knotweed in your garden, knotweed that has driven property owners to suicide because they can't get rid of it. Well, it's putting a lot of the fishing industry, which is very local and very artisanal in Italy, out of business. But what also, it just amused me because when we read about lionfish and other invasive species that sound weird and we're not really going to like them, but we know it's a good idea to eat them, to listen to all of these Venetian chefs say, you know, blue crab isn't so bad because it's a cult item in this country. We love taking wooden mallets on a piece of brown paper on a picnic bench with Old Bay seasoning and, you know, having
Talk
crab
about
picnic
romantic. Listen to you. Go ahead. No, it's, you know, by the way, we had a couple. I hope I have it's it was Nova, right? Nova was in here. Some Nova people were in here a couple of weeks ago about another invasive crab species. We know the Gulf of Maine is heating, warming faster than any body of water like in the world. And obviously, we know the impact, lobsters, etc. But I think it's these green crabs, which are an invasive species there that you also shouldn't root for, that are eating all the damn clams and whatever and destroying all these other industries. And it sounds like, which I found to be interesting, the Italian chefs are trying to accommodate, correct me if I'm wrong, Corby, the advent of the blue crab to put them on the menu, while in the Gulf of Maine, they're trying to figure out ways to creatively circumvent the arrival of the green crab and to protect, like, for example, the clam industry. Am I right about that, or am I?
You're absolutely right, and I'm glad you brought up green crab because I couldn't remember the name of it. As I recall, green crabs are not easy to eat or to make, and they're not particularly good. So there's this sort of amusing irony in the Venetian chefs having to adapt to something that's considered delicious and a prized delicacy in the US. But in both cases, they're decimating local populations, they're invasive, and it's a really bad thing. And fishery management has no idea how to stop it.
Now, can we return to salmon for just one second? I forgot to tell the story. When Roger Berkowitz still owned Legal Seafood, right before he sold it, we went out there and he had these salmon that came from New Zealand. Do you know about this? That were hand massaged by the, this is true, by the people who raised them in New Zealand. They only sold like 12 every quarter of the year or something like that. They literally every day went out and massaged the salmon with, look at the look
on
your face.
Is this consensual?
No.
That's why I have the look on my face. I'm wondering how the salmon feels.
Well, that's, I didn't ask that question. I should have. And I have to say to you, ordinarily when I hear these kind of stories, I say, come on, you can't tell the difference. You could tell the difference when you're eating the hand massage salmon. And I love salmon, just like you do, yeah. And the other salmon. So I just like to put that on the table.
I just
for
wonder how many lawyers he had to hire to fight the harassment suit.
Well, whatever. By the way, the guy who wrote The Beautiful Swimmers is not Weaver, it's Warner, for whatever it's
William
worth.
William Warner.
Warner, thank,
thank you
very
Weaver
much.
Is an Italian, writes Italian poetry.
Whoever
but
he is.
Can I just say that it is
you
a very Italian thing to do to try to deal with the invasion by incorporating it
into
a menu.
Your thing, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's just a very, the food thing for Italians. It's just a very Italian thing to do.
Okay, well, how do you get to be one of your, what did you say at the beginning? You're out at Aspen and those, not students, what do they call those people that work?
No, these are fellows.
How do you become a fellow?
You apply. We were very lucky. We had almost 300 applications for 18 spots.
Wow.
It opens in October, closes in December. And then we go through these 300 or so applications and do 70 full-length interviews.
How about having a legendary diner from New England as a fellow at the Aspen Institute next season?
How about having a legendary diner as a mentor? Because we do one-to-one mentor match.
Ooh, I would love that, Corby. We'll talk after the show.
Okay.
I don't suppose you have any room for anybody who just likes invasive species. No,
you know, we
nothing.
Always need different points of view.
Beautiful.
It's good to
That's
see you,
Corby.
Corby.
For you. Nice to see you,
and
Corby Cummer. Bye.
We've been speaking with food policy analyst Corby Cummer. He's executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. Up next, our tech guru, Andy Iannatko, on the first major internet bills meant to protect children. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.